And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We have John Tobin coming up with the news in a sec. Andy Fleming will be joining us for part two on asteroids and just new technology that's come out that might just save our behinds when it comes to asteroids. Our guest today is Ryan Mullahy. He is going to be talking about Incident Exeter. And I don't know if you have time to Google that right now, but it is really quite a fascinating case, police department involved and everything. He's a researcher in the state of New Hampshire, and we're going to be talking about other goings on. Go to Podcast UFO right now if you're listening live and sign up on our chat room. You can ask the guest today some questions or just plain interact. It's always a lot of fun on the chat room. That's at podcastufo.com. One of the listeners writes me at least once a month and says for me to announce out there for someone to get started on a Podcast UFO Wikipedia article. Now, I don't know if that's what's involved in that. But if you're a listener out there, he's claiming that it's going to generate a lot more listeners. If someone wants to go ahead and do that, anything for the show to move it forward, I would appreciate it. It's totally up to you if you have the time and the inclination. Well, that's all I have for right now. Next week, we have Judy Meseline from the UFO Watchtower on. John, how are you doing today?
I am doing fabulous, Martin. How are you?
Great. Great. It's we're both up in the Northeast here, so we've been putting up with all this wretched weather. I'm ready for spring. I'm sure you are, too.
I am absolutely ready for spring. We did have sort of a glimpse of spring over this past weekend that went by us, and that was nice.
Yeah, that's right. It was 47 degrees.
We had 50 here, which was amazing. I had, my Speedo on when I'm wandering down the street.
Yeah. You had to one-up me, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Yeah. Not rubbing in or anything, but, you know.
Yeah. All right. So what's up for the news this week?
Hey, you know what's really cool? We've got some great news and some new UFO shows coming on. That it's just great that time of the year where some of the new shows are coming out. And these ones sound pretty interesting. So let me tell you about some of these. Now, our guest coming up for April 2nd, John Ventry of Pennsylvania, has landed the lead role in History Channel's new series, Hangar One. The show will air Fridays at 10 p.m. after Ancient Aliens. Ventry said, "I got the Giorgio role only without the hair for obvious reasons." The show, Hangar One, is premiering on February 28th. So that looks to be a really interesting show. He is going to be a great guest. We look forward to having him on. And not a heck of a lot of details on that, but there is some more details and, of course, the full length to this story on our show notes on the podcast UFO.
When he says for obvious reasons, if you look at his picture, he's bald.
Yes, and I can relate to that. I can't pull off the Giorgio role either way, but certainly not for my hair. There's another new show coming out, or it's actually already started, I believe, just recently. This one deals with abductions, invasions, and conspiracy theories about aliens, which surround our world every day, from nightly news to video games to the latest box office hit. Delving into the photoshopping of space, the value of WikiLeaks, and the role social media plays in alien stories, Alien Files offers a unique 360-degree look at how alien interaction may have affected our past and how it will affect our future. And the source code on this story is from Destination America. It does air on the Destination America Network on Thursdays at 10 p.m. It's a half-an-hour show. They are currently airing this show, so you can catch them this Thursday, tomorrow night, at 10 p.m. on Destination America if you want to go ahead and check that out. One thing that caught my eye in here now, and I just heard a little follow-up on this story, actually talking about the value of WikiLeaks. They now have the Wiki Depends for anyone that has that problem. So it's
that's good to know.
Yes, it's good. Yeah. It's valuable information to add to that if you have that problem. So anyway, on the Science Channel, there's a new show coming out with a kind of a familiar name in the UFO world. It's called Close Encounters. Science Channel will explore the countless UFO sightings, which are reported from thousands of regions around the globe. Many of these sightings are documented and investigated. Most of them can be accounted for by weather patterns, flight schedules, or extraordinary imagination. But a select few are considered unsolved extraterrestrial puzzles that police investigators, government officials, and even medical communities cannot explain. Now, Close Encounters premieres on Tuesday, March 4th and Friday, March 7th, so I assume they'll be doing two episodes that week, at 10 and 10:30 p.m., and that is on Science Channel, which is a great channel, I think. And again, a full link to that story can be found on the show notes.
Now, that show in particular already ran up in Canada, and there was a lot of people raving about how good it was. You know, if you look online, you'll see some, you know, naysayers, but there's always that. But still, from what I understand, it's a pretty good show. Now, I do have to say that Colby Landrum, who is a past guest on our show, did somehow watch the that episode that involved the Cash Landrum case, and he was very upset about something. I don't know, you know, what exactly happened, but I believe there were some inaccuracies that really bothered him. So that show in particular, I'm not sure how clear it was, but most of the shows are pretty good from what I understand.
Yeah, they're getting good feedback. I've done a little bit of research on the net, you know, just looking up and seeing what the initial feedback was. And they're getting pretty good feedback, all things considering. I think some of the, you know, as opposed to a lot of the new ghost shows coming out, some of these new UFO shows are really, looks like they're really taking their time to do it right and not just put, you know, put crap, shall we say, out there, instead of giving something for the viewer to view and delve their teeth into. There's some other great news out there. Now, this is this next news story is something that I've thought about quite a bit. It kind of relates to this whole, you know, when we're dreaming, are we really dreaming, or is our conscious state the dream? Goes into that a little bit. Is this universe just a futuristic simulation? Who knows, but it's certainly fun to think about. Is the universe a simulation? Is the headline for the New York Times op-ed, which was written by Edward Frankel, a professor of mathematics at the University of California, Berkeley. Frankel discusses the unique line of thinking about mathematicians and philosophers analyzing the history of abstract thought, as well as the concept that everything we know is a hologram, which I find fascinating. Martin, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, first, I should say that we're stealing this news from the work that Peggy does on our Facebook page. And yes, I've heard this this idea or theory for a number of years. You know, I mean, there's so many baffling things in the universe. Who's to say that this isn't as good of an answer as a lot of the other ones? It really is it's really a fascinating concept.
Yeah, it is. And I've heard a little bit about this, but I'd certainly, you know, as more is delved into it, you know, it's one of those theories that it's probably never going to be able to be proven, but it's certainly worth looking into. You know, who are we to say what's real and what's not, right?
Right.
The next story we've got is an interesting one, too, because it's kind of frightening to me. We all heard about everyone's familiar with the Russian asteroid that crashed in and injured and hurt, you know, hundreds of people about a year ago or so. Well, this one is about a monster asteroid whizzing past Earth just a year after that Russian explosion. A gigantic asteroid has whizzed close to Earth around a year after another exploded over Russia. The space rock, which measures about 270 meters, 885 feet wide, layman's terms, that's a Kardashian butt wide, raced past the planet at about 27,000 miles per hour, 3 a.m. Central CET time on Tuesday. The asteroid came within about 1.6 million miles of Earth, which doesn't sound that close, but in terms of asteroids and how close they normally come to Earth, that's pretty close, right?
It is. You know, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how far the furthest satellites are, but a lot of these babies go right through the orbits of the satellites. And yeah, it's a little close. And what always gets me is usually that's on an elliptical course that's coming back. And, you know, actually we have Andy Fleming on the line, and he's going to be giving us a follow-up that kind of ties into this asteroid. This is part two. Andy was on for part one last week on asteroids. And how you doing, Andy?
I'm doing absolutely fine. Hello to both of you, John and Martin.
We're great, and we're glad to have you on. So there's some new ways to search asteroids, right? Do you want to talk about that?
For people who've been having trouble with their asteroids, JPL have come up with something called synthetic tracking, which is a method that's set to revolutionize near-Earth asteroid discovery. It's a new technique. It's going to work 1,000 times faster than ever before. And to date, Martin, have a guess, ballpark figure, how many of these little asteroids they've found?
Oh, found.
Yes, so far in our history of the last 10
years. I'm going to say it's only like 1 or 2% of all the asteroids on the asteroid belt.
Yeah, so they reckon it's about 10,000. And of these, more than 1,000 are bigger than a kilometer in size. They're not the problem. The problem are the smaller ones, which probably number in their millions. And it's finding these smaller ones. It's very, very difficult because they are very, very faint. Yeah? Mm. Now, there's a guy at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and his team called Michael Shaw, who've developed a brand new way to spot and track these very faint, fast-moving objects, which John has just been on about. Very frightening because it came within a fraction of the lunar distance from here to the moon, this particular one that John was talking about last week, the week before. These guys say that their new technique could increase the rate of discovery by a factor of 1,000. So hopefully fewer and fewer of these things will be literally coming out of the blue at us. Basically, technically, instead of taking a single 30-second exposure, which they do now, they're going to take lots of much shorter exposures and freeze the position of the near-Earth asteroid in those. It'll be the stars that will look dim rather than the asteroids. And they call it synthetic tracking. And these sequences of images of the particular small asteroid will contain about 120 pictures. Apparently, I know very little about computers, but to get them all morphed together or whatever, it uses quite a lot of computational power, but apparently JPL say it's chicken feed for today's state-of-the-art computers. They've been using this technique on the 200-inch telescope at the Palomar Observatory in California. By repeating the process later the same night, they can get a handle on what you were just talking about, the asteroid's orbit, and then follow up observations on nights after that should pin down that orbit accurately. Apparently, in the last 5 years, astronomers have identified near-Earth asteroids with a size of a few tens of meters at a rate of only 30 a year. So you'd be looking at 30 or 40,000 a year. So we're going to get a lot of them sussed, the majority of them. And they say, apparently, Shaw and his team, that with a 5-meter telescope, synthetic tracking should spot about 80 of these objects every night. And NASA is actually hoping to use the results to send a crewed mission to a near-Earth asteroid in a program called the Asteroid Grand Challenge, which will in itself identify yet more potential targets.
Andy, now, does this mean that B612 is no longer looking into launching that telescope they were going to? Do you happen to know anything about that?
All I know is that B612 were on target for later in the decade. This, to me, is, this is a ground-based venture, which,
right,
by its very definition, has to be a lot, lot cheaper. I mean, the state of today's telescopes, like the Keck using adaptive optics and some of the other big ones, you know, it's getting to the stage where we can get things, we can remove theoretically and practically the Earth's atmosphere to stop that shimmering, the glimmering of stars, twinkle, twinkle, little star, mm-hmm. and we can start making Hubble-like images from telescopes on the ground. That's a lot cheaper. It's got a lot less risk than having to launch by putting a telescope up on a booster, because to start with, the failure rate of boosters, you know, you're putting a multi-million pound machine into orbit. You're lucky if it gets there.
Right. So, Andy, thanks a lot, and we'll be talking to you next week.
Lovely to talk to you guys. Look forward to speaking to you next week.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Andy.
So, John, we really are like a sitting target, as all the craters attest to that.
It's really frightening. You know, it's something that I don't think about that often, but as more and more this stuff is happening, it's, I don't know. I mean, it seems like there would be better warning systems when this comes this close, and oftentimes we're hearing about this stuff either after the fact or what have you. It is pretty frightening.
You know, I've heard people say, like, if we really want to survive as a society, then we should be looking into off-planet, put our species out on different planets just, to continue, in case something like this happens, a major asteroid hits and we're all wiped out like the dinosaurs.
Yeah, it kind of goes hand in hand with a lot of the folks that are doing what they call doomsday prepping. You know, they're planning yeah. for catastrophes and things that we can't control. So, it does kind of, there's something to be said for that.
Well, I think all we have to do is really hitch a ride on a UFO and see where they're going, see where they came from. Hey, so thanks so much, John, and we'll be talking to you next week.
Sounds great. I'm Martin, looking forward to it. Thank you for having me.
And we have Ryan Mulahy coming right up after the music break. Don't go away. Well, this is always one of those fears that, can happen when you're doing live radio. And Ryan, if you happen to be listening, you should be calling in. He was supposed to call promptly at 8:16. It's 8:17. So here I am all alone here and waiting for Ryan to call, which should be any moment right now. And so we have a lot of people on the message board, and I encourage you to go on the message board right now. That's at podcastufo.com. And why don't you throw me a question? Why don't you do that so I can at least talk to you out there right now? Tonight, we're going to be talking about the Exeter incident. Here is Ryan now, Saved by the Bell. And here he is. Ryan Mulahy, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. We were, I was a little worried about you here because, the music ended and there was no Ryan on board.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, there must have been a delay on my computer. I apologize.
Oh, that could be. Can you get a little closer to the phone, please? Just we're hearing,
sure.
From the producer that you're not quite loud enough.
How's this? Is this better?
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds
excellent.
Good. All right. So, Ryan, before we get to talking about today's topic. Incident Exeter, or Exeter Incident, whatever it's called, back in 1965. Can you give the listener a little background? First of all, I want to say, if you're listening live, please jump over to podcastufo.com and get on the message board and fire some questions away. And so I'd like to know how you got involved. You're kind of a young guy, or you appear to be. How did you get involved in the UFO phenomena in the beginning?
I've had an interest my whole life, growing up, kind of a passing interest. And in the winter of 1998-99, I had a UFO sighting in New Hampshire with two acquaintances that, was pretty compelling and, got me interested in the subject. So that was, really the catalyst for me starting to, research UFOs in New England and specifically New Hampshire. So that's how I got started.
I see. Now, did your friends actually also get kind of involved in looking into the subject?
Actually, they didn't. They were acquaintances. They weren't ultra close friends of mine. And, it's something that I've, followed up with them over the years. But they didn't kind of have the same reaction as me.
Now, can you just give a real quick description of the sighting?
Sure, of my sighting?
Yeah.
Sure. We were traveling on Route 13, returning from a trip to New Hampshire, returning to Massachusetts, and basically driving. It was late winter. It was, you know, still light out, but it was just starting to start getting dark, but the sun was still out. And basically we were driving down Route 13, and we basically saw an object in the sky not too far off of the road above the tree line, which appeared to go down into the woods. It was a, you know, very odd-looking object, pretty hard to describe, and it was just very quick. We saw it go straight down into the woods. There was no sound, and that was basically it.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that really threw me when I had my sighting back in 2006 was the fact that what I saw had no sound, and it was like it just didn't make any sense, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing that until if you're not into UFOs and you don't hear other people say that, you have no idea that that's what's going to happen, and it really takes you back, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to see something, you know, in ours it was daytime too, which, you know, having it be still light out, you know, and seeing what we saw, you know, it was, it just, you know, we didn't have the, you know, the shade of night to kind of, you know, and the thing we saw was in fairly close proximity. It wasn't off in the distance in the sky. So it was, you know, it was pretty compelling.
Now, before we get into Incident Exeter, which I keep saying we're going to do, I jumped on your blog, which is New Hampshire UFO Research, I believe it is.
Yeah, yes.
And, interesting. And I saw the photo that, you know, I'm in the antiques and fine arts and all that, you know, for, it's a passion of mine and all that. And I really was intrigued by this cigar shaped photo, stereopticon view card, that was, I think in the 1870s. And, when I first saw that, I go, oh my God, wow, that's an early photo. And, you know, I wondered all about that. Now, can you crack that? That was, it was not a hoax, but it was not in the sky. It was actually on a frozen mountain or something. Was it Mount Washington?
It was Mount Washington, yeah. So that case, basically what it is in 2002, a photo was purchased from eBay by a gentleman named Samuel Sherman, who purchased the photo in question from eBay. You know, alleged that it was a UFO photo, you know, did a couple interviews, or there was a few articles about it, and, you know, just having it be a New Hampshire, supposed New Hampshire UFO picture, I was always intrigued by it. So initially, the only version of the photo that was available was a highly cropped, low-res version of the photo. So all you could really see is some white swirling in the background and then this cigar-shaped object. So that was really, in 2002, that was about all the information, you know, that was available. But, you know, it was something I went to back to from time to time, and there's a number of other people who have done articles and written about it. And, you know, I reference some of those people in my article because, you know, I don't want to take all the credit for it. There's a bunch of different people that have looked into it, and, you know, I basically just kept at it. But what I discovered in 2008 was that the New York Public Library had the full set of these photos. And what had happened was in 1870, there was an expedition to the top of Mount Washington by the Army Signal Corps and some scientists. And they took two photographers up to the top of them to document it. And they took a 41-photo picture set, which is where this, you know, picture in question came from. And so once I located the actual set of photos and looked at the photo that had been not cropped and that was in full resolution, it's very clear that it's an object that's in a pile of snow on the surface of the mountain and not an object in the clouds, as it was alleged.
Right. And you can't really see that right off the bat. I mean, that's pretty tricky. So getting back to Exeter Incident, I grew up, I don't know, maybe 10 miles away or 15 miles away from Exeter, and right not too far away from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I vaguely remember hearing about this, because I was very young, but back at that time, back in 1965, I mean, I was really young, but back in that time, there was a lot going on in that whole area. Everybody was looking for UFOs, everybody was talking about them. And you heard about Betty and Barney Hill, of course. And so there was a lot going on. So why don't you, for the person that's never heard about Incident Exeter, why don't you just start from the beginning and tell the whole story?
Sure. So it was September 3rd, 1965, and Norman Muscarello, who was an 18-year-old young man, was hitchhiking back from Amesbury, Massachusetts, on Route 150 to Exeter, where he lived. At some point in his journey, he was hitchhiking pretty late at night. So at one point, he got to the town called Kensington, which actually the UFO incident actually happened in Kensington. But because it was so close to Exeter, they call it the incident Exeter. But it actually took place in Kensington. So as Norman was hiking home and he was walking by a farm, a red glowing object appeared over the farm and started swooping down at him. And he became frightened, dove next to a wall to, you know, shield himself, and then tried to bang on the door of the farmhouse. The people wouldn't let him in because he was very frantic. And so he was able to then flag a car down and have them bring him directly to Exeter Police Station. Now, at just about the same time, Officer Eugene Bertrand was on patrol, and he came upon a car on Route 101 that had two women in it that were very frightened and that claimed that a red object had been swooping down at their car. So, you know, Norman showed up at the police station and told Scratch Tolan, who was the dispatch, his story. And then all of a sudden, Eugene Bertrand is calling in, you know, with this story about the lady. So because of those reasons, I think, you know, the cops were, you know, they gave it a bit of credence, and they knew Norman, and he was kind of known as a tough, no-nonsense kid, and he was pretty shooken up. So Officer Bertrand returned to the police station, retrieved Norman. They both went back out to the field where Norman had his sighting, and when they got there, they went out into the middle of the field, and sure enough, the UFO came up over the trees and was right over Norman and Officer Bertrand right in the field. Now, Officer Bertrand was so frightened that he dropped to his knee and pulled his gun, but then, you know, was worried about radiation because in both the case when the UFO showed up first for Norman at the farm and when he went back with Officer Bertrand, the whole field turned red and there was an animal reaction from the animals at the farm. So Officer Bertrand grabbed Norman, brought him back up to the cruiser. He called in saying he saw the UFO as well, and Officer David Hunt was already en route to the scene. He showed up, and then for the next 8 or 9 minutes, Officer Hunt and Bertrand stood there, you know, going through every possible thing that it could be, you know, and just not being able to come up with any conventional explanation for what they were seeing. So that's the thumbnail on it.
Now, there were other sightings as well in the area during this week?
Well, there was a good amount of sightings leading up to it. And then also that night, there was also another report, because when they finally returned after Officer Bertrand and Norman having the sighting, when they returned to the police station, they actually had a call patch through from, I believe it was the local operator, that a frantic man called from Hampton saying that there was some sort of UFO over his car. And the officers actually went as far as to go to the hospital either late that night or the next day to see if, you know, possibly anybody there, you know, had been hurt or, you know, had been admitted for anything like that. So, you know, if we count all those, that's about 5 or 6 people within a few hours time that night. And there also had been, a good amount of sightings at Pease, also by the Coast Guard in that area.
Right. Where I lived, I could actually see the landing strip at Pease. So there was and I was across the river and actually Maine, but up on a hill. We had a house up on a hill and could see right over there. And we were always looking over there to see if we could see any UFOs because there was always stories about them over there. Norman Muscarello, or however you say his name,
mm-hmm.
is he still with us, and does he talk about this?
Unfortunately, Norman passed away. I believe it was either 2003 or 2005. He passed away so he's no longer with us, but his brother is still lives in Exeter, and I've met him before. He's a very nice guy, and he's still, we'll talk about it because he was a younger kid at the time, and he has pretty vivid memories of the aftermath, of everything with the press and the military coming and, talking to Norman and his mother. So so he is still around. And I believe that as far as the officers, I believe that they have both passed away.
Huh. Now, I remember hearing when I heard about the story was long before I actually ever really get really interested in UFOs after I had my sighting. So I would say that it was sometime in high school I either read something, but I remember hearing that Norman, when he went to the police station, they just plain old didn't believe him at all. And but they saw how panicked he was, and he just wouldn't let go of it. And that's when they finally, took some action and actually, investigated a little bit.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of them knowing him as a tough young guy being so scared, and then the fact that, this completely independent report from these two ladies that Officer Bertrand, the description fit what Norman had described. So I'm not sure as to how much they believed him or didn't believe him at the time. I'm sure that they were probably very skeptical of it, but I think it was because of those two reasons that they followed up on it.
You know, you always hear when there's any type of major incident, I don't care if it's Roswell or Rendlesham Forest or anything like that, you always hear the skeptics, their trial on debunking whatever incident it is. In this one, oh my God, when you read the skeptical inquiry explanation, when they say that it was a refueling of a tanker and that it had lights like that, and that's the blunt explanation of what they were seeing. And then you hear about the whole story of it, and it doesn't add up at all. It doesn't even come close.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, I'm familiar with that article, and it's very troubling because, I've read the article, and Joe Nickel and James McGuy, I believe, wrote it, and it's just very clear, just having studied this case for almost 15 years now, when you read their explanation of the case, there's so many holes in it. There's so many things that don't jive with the documented facts of the case that, it's very troubling. And, the first thing that we have to consider is that Eugene Bertrand, the officer, he was a veteran of the Korean War. He had 4 years refueling experience with KC-97 refueling planes, which is what the skeptical inquirer tried to claim that the officers at Norman, saw. David Hunt was in the Army Reserve for 4 years. He spent 31 years in law enforcement well after, the incident. These guys were both very intelligent veterans who, patrolled that area every night and were very familiar with the planes from Pease and all these different things. So for the skeptical inquirer to suggest that these two gentlemen in Norman, who said in plain English they saw something about 100 feet over them, that just doesn't reconcile. And then, in doing some research into that, I did a lot of research into KC-97 refueling jets, and they can't, after talking with a few people that have experience refueling, they can't refuel at anything less than 5,000 feet, especially over a resident population. So, I think if you weigh the credibility and experience with aviation of, Officer Bertrand, and then you also take into account that, these planes can't be refueling at less than 5,000 feet, I think that, it busts a hole wide open in what they've suggested. And just to add to that, when the incident initially happened, the Pentagon threw everything they could at it. It was stars, it was planets, it was weather inversions, it was the lights from Pease, it was a banner plane. And Raymond Fowler, who did the initial investigation that John G. Fuller's book was based on, Incident Exeter. Raymond did all the investigation on it, and he, you know, was very diligent. Anytime they would offer up, you know, an explanation, he checked with the Banner Plane Company. He proved that that wasn't true. You know, Raymond Fowler really, you know, kept on the Pentagon and Project Blue Book, and anytime they offered up these explanations, you know, he kind of shot them down. And then, you know, there was talk of it being this refueling mission, Operation Big Blast Coco, but then that was also proven to be over at 12:35, which would be a full hour before Norman, 1:35, which would have been a full hour before Norman and Officer Bertrand's sighting. So I think for those reasons that I've listed, you know, I don't think that the skeptical inquirer's explanation, you know, it's reaching as far as my opinion.
Well, at least they didn't say swamp gas, right?
Exactly. At least.
We have a couple of questions on the message board. Tony is asking, in a general way, was there any hard evidence collected from the woods, or did anyone try to, actually?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, you know, there was a lot of talk of possible physical evidence because, as you remember, you know, this thing happened over the field next to the farm. Now, I haven't been able to get any hard documents proving this, but this is discussion that's, you know, been included in reports that the military was very interested in any reaction by the animals after the fact, and there was talk that they were down there, you know, taking a look at the field. So there was talk of, you know, an examination of the area and inquiries, but there was never any, you know, any evidence spoken of, if they did collect it, in the public or anything in the declassified Blue Book files. So, but it seemed like, you know, the military was interested in that possibility.
Yeah. Now, I know the Air Force, actually, they couldn't come up with an explanation, if I remember right.
Yeah, well, initially they tried to. It was interesting because they offered an answer to what it was before they even had finished their investigation, which Raymond Fowler called them out on. And also the two officers sent two fairly angry letters to Blue Book saying, look, you know, we know what we saw. We're, you know, intelligent people, and we're getting a lot of harassment because people are, you know, making light of what we saw. So initially they tried to explain it, but what ended up happening was Exeter, because of all these sightings in 1965 and 66, Gerald Ford actually called one of the congressional, only I believe there's only two congressional hearings on UFOs in 1966, and the Exeter case was one of the highlighted cases, and J. Allen Hynek had to admit under oath right during the congressional hearing that it was an unknown, and that even though they had tried to prescribe some of these other explanations, that ultimately it was still an unknown case.
I see. Now I'm going to combine two questions on the message board. And by the way, if you're listening on Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com. And join the message board if you'd like to throw a couple of questions at Ryan. Let's see. Eric is asking or stating here, New England has some great historic sightings, but what about sightings recently? And with that, I'm going to add another question on the bottom. This is a guest, unknown guest, that is asking, have there been any more sightings since? And I'm assuming he means in the Exeter area.
Okay. As far as more recent sightings, you know, there's you know, always a good amount of sightings up here. You know, I do follow those, you know, fairly closely. As far as anything significant, the really last significant thing that happened in New Hampshire as far as UFOs was probably back in about 2008, I believe, where there was a gentleman that claimed to have seen a large mothership type UFO when he was out mowing his lawn during the day. And his report was given a bit of credence because apparently he had a former aviation military background. And, you know, I guess he was vetted by the National UFO Reporting Center, or they, you know, they didn't reveal who he was at the time, but there was a number of articles about that, and there was also, I believe there was a second sighting within that little gap. So that's probably as far as kind of bigger stuff, but there's definitely, you know, sightings all the time. And I'm sorry, what was the second question?
Basically, has there been any sightings in Exeter itself?
Oh, okay. Yes, I mean, that area has remained an area where things have been reported over the years, you know, even up until, you know, current times. Just, you know, within that, there was a lot within that cluster of 65, 66 in the Exeter area. But, I mean, there have been even some, you know, as recent as this year or 2013, you know, from Exeter and the Kensington area. So, you know, it seems that before and both after, you know, that area seems to be one of New Hampshire's spots where there's been a lot of stuff sighted.
Now, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I want to bring something up when we're talking about something recent. And that is, this is when I say I don't want to beat a dead horse for people that listen to the show regularly, but I was actually I was actually in my studio in Maine doing this show live when in my backyard a neighbor saw a large triangle and tried to knock on my door right during the show.
Oh, wow.
Just to let you know that. And I've spoke to her since, and, you know, she doesn't really want to talk about it now.
Yeah.
But I think there is a lot in New England going on. And, you know, I've been out on that very same golf course, which is behind my house. And, you know, I think I saw the International Space Station. I don't know what it was, but it was big. But, you know, it just seems like there's, you know, big open skies. You can get away from light pollution fairly easy. So you can actually, you know, see a lot of it. If anything's going on, you can see it.
Definitely. You know, it is, you know, New Hampshire at night, you can see the stars very good, you know, depending where you are. And, you know, as far as the White Mountains, you know, that area, you know, the unique thing about that and other mountainous areas in New Hampshire is, you know, you have a situation where, you know, you're in kind of valleys between these mountains. So, you know, that's interesting too, you know, with the Betty and Barney Hill case, you know, when they were having the sighting of this object, that, you know, first it was up in the sky and then it was kind of coming down in between the mountains, you know. So, yeah, definitely.
Right. Now, let's see, Peter Davenport was on this case pretty strongly, and I think Jerome Clark might have researched it a bit. What Peggy wanted to know, why does this case interest you?
Well, I mean, the case interests me first and foremost because, you know, after I had my sighting, when I started looking into, you know, New England cases, there were some similarities in the characteristics that the UFO exhibited that were similar to what I saw. So I think because it was a New Hampshire case, there were some similarities to what I saw. You know, that was what brought my interest. But I think, you know, the Exeter case is, you know, a very important case because, you know, it's one, if you really go over, you know, a lot of these historic classes cases, it's one of the cases that really stands the test of time as far as, you know, the credibility of the witnesses and the fact that there was, you know, multiple independent witnesses within that time period, the fact that the cops were so experienced and viewed that. So, you know, I think it's a very significant case for New Hampshire, and I think it's a very significant case just in ufology, you know, American ufology. And I think, you know, obviously the Betty and Barney Hill case is probably the most well-known New Hampshire UFO case, and, you know, that rightfully so. I mean, it's a very, you know, well-known case, and it's had a lot of cultural significance. But, you know, the Exeter case, I would hold it right up there. I think it's, you know, there's a bit more, you know, having the police there during the thing, having that sort of credible witness there helps it a lot. So that's pretty much what drew me to it, that it's a very credible case, and there's a lot of documents, and there's a lot of materials to go over.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times people say, well, why do we keep talking about the old cases? But, you know, something you just said there kind of strikes pretty solid, and that is, you know, some of these cases just plain stand the test of time, and, you know, there's never an answer for it. And, you know, I don't know where you can go with something like that. But one of the things that came to mind, had anyone claimed any type of an abduction or anything like that related to that? You know how sometimes people come forward afterwards and say they had missing time or something like that. Did anyone do anything like that?
In as far as the incident at Exeter, not that I'm aware of, no. You know, the officers at Norman, I'm not aware of anything like that at all. But, you know, to what you said a second ago about, you know, the people that say, why bother? You know, this is something that I hear a lot because I tend to focus on more of the historic, you know, I like the older cases myself. You know, people say that a lot, and I don't agree with it because just in my experience, it's a myth that there's no new information that can be gleaned from old data. I think that's a myth. And I also think that, you know, like look at cold case files. I mean, there's a reason why there's cold case files, mm-hmm. because putting fresh eyes and applying the latest information and technology to a mystery can often glean new information. So, you know, I think for that reason, I think it's important to go back if you have the interest over the old cases. You know, I think it's very important. And I think it's also important for people getting into the UFO phenomenon to understand the history of it. If you really want to try and get a grasp of, you know, the phenomenon since 1947, it's really important that you go back to the beginning and learn what has happened, you know, as far as the government, Project Blue Book, all of the documented things that we can, you know, read documents about and that we know, you know, have happened. I think that's really important too. So I think the past is very important when it comes to this subject.
I agree 100% with everything you just said.
It makes
total sense to, you know, I mean, you're right. You know, you look at any cold case file and you can actually put that into like a murder case. You know, I mean, they're always cracking murder cases when new technology comes along, like, you know, DNA came along. And, you know, now we have, like someone's just typing right now on the chat room, has anyone tried to get a FOIA request regarding the incident? And we have FOIA. You know, sometimes more things can be brought forward through Freedom of Information Act, you know,
Definitely.
By requesting documents. Has anyone tried to get any papers on that?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if they have. You know, the Exeter case, you know, the Project Blue Book file is obviously declassified. That is out there. The briefing document from the congressional hearing from 1966, that is out there. So there's a lot of data out there, but, I mean, that is a great idea. I mean, that is something that maybe somebody should look into, you know, maybe just to make sure that there isn't anything maybe lingering. But, you know, it's just from, you know, being at it for 14 years, I think it's a great idea. But, you know, it's definitely a very detail-rich case compared to most cases. So there's a lot out there to read on it.
Right. Now, is there any other case that you kind of dove into like you did on this one in the area?
You know, I mean, I don't think there's one that I've spent quite as much time on. I mean, I've done extensive research on, you know, the Betty and Barney Hill case, although, you know, I think Kathleen Martin and Stan Friedman, you know, they have that case pretty well represented. So, you know, not that I don't like discussing the case, but I just, you know, I'm very fascinated with a lot of these cases like Exeter and some other cases that aren't well known. But another case that's very, very, very fascinating is another, you know, police case from New Hampshire, which was on October 16, 1984. And this is referred to as the Zeller incident. And basically, what happened was is the Keene Police Department got a phone call saying that there was something hovering over the city. So Officer Zeller, you know, I don't think he really believed the report, but was like, all right, we have to go check it out. So he got in his car and headed down to the area where this object was claimed to be hovering over the city. So as he was driving down the road, all of a sudden he's seen another car veer off the road and the people jump out pointing in the sky. So he looks up, there's this object. So he pulls his cruiser over. He's observing this object, and I guess from what I understand, a crowd of about close to 30 people gathered along with the police officer watching this thing. So he decided he was going to aim his spotlight from the cruiser at this object, which was hovering, you know, I believe it was around 500 or 600 feet in the air. As soon as he aimed his light at this object, it started floating towards the cruiser and descending at the same time. Hmm. Apparently the people, you know, around panicked and kind of run and were scared. And, you know, the cop just kept the light on this object and it floated right over him in the cop car at about 100 feet and just floated away. So that one is another, you know, there's a lot of cases in New Hampshire where there's police involvement. And, you know, as far as my research, you know, I always like to try and focus in on cases that involve the police, military, credible citizens, things where there's documents, things where there's things that I can, you know, research and dig into. And the Zeller incident, that's another great one where it's very hard to kind of, you know, explain that away with just, you know, kind of conventional aircraft. So
I think that sounds like a weather balloon to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am just kidding. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have I don't know, about, I don't know, maybe 5 to 7 minutes left. And do you want to talk about any of the stories in your blog, or would you like to talk some more about, let me just throw a question at you.
Sure.
You're kind of a young person in the field. What do you think about disclosure? Do you think that's ever going to happen?
I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but, you know, I know there's lots of kind of viewpoints and theories on, is it going to happen, how it's going to happen. And, you know, just from studying all the declassified documents I have, I just have a hard time believing that, you know, the government's ever going to come out and, you know, just kind of tell us that's, you know, that there's aliens or UFOs or, you know. So, I mean, it's tough because I guess with disclosure, we're alluding to the fact that the government knows what UFOs are, you know. And I don't know, you know, I try and keep a very open mind as far as my, you know, my views on UFOs. And, you know, I feel that it's important in doing research in this area that I'm, you know, I'm not leaning too far to one ear, you know, to being too skeptical or being, you know, too accepting of things. So I think it's a possibility. But as far as the government doing it, I don't think that's probably going to be, you know, going to happen. But,
you know, it's funny. I ask a lot of the guests that I have on the show that question, and, you know, pretty much across the board, the same answer, you know, everyone has more or less the same answer, unless you're asking Stephen Bassett.
Yeah. I think the more you look into the documents that were once classified and you look at the extent that they, you know, looked into things and at certain times how secret they were keeping it, for me, that's the big thing that says to me, you know, I don't know that this is something that they're going to, you know, they're going to come out and just reveal.
Yeah. Yeah. And, oops, well, let's see. We have another question here. I am sorry. It's funny. This chat board kind of floats up sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know what? It's gone. So, sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah. Do you attend any conferences? Do you ever speak? You're very well spoken at this.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Actually, I was involved with helping Dean Merchant, who was the original creator of the Exeter UFO Festival. I'm a, you know, a colleague and a friend of Dean, and I did help him, you know, a little bit as far as consulting and doing some of the social media for Exeter. I was slated to speak in 2012, but unfortunately, 2013. I was supposed to speak this past summer, but they had to cancel the Exeter Festival due to a fire at the town hall where it was normally held. So I haven't done any speaking yet on the subject. I was supposed to do Exeter, but that got canceled. You know, I guess it's tough because I guess I am a little mixed on, you know, the UFO conferences and stuff like that. I have kind of mixed feelings about them. So it would have to, I'd have to take it on an individual basis, you know, like
sure
which one it was, where is it, who's going to be speaking there, because, you know, I think that's the one, you know, there's one of the negatives to those things is, you know, they don't always focus on evidence and documentation. And so, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, alien tchotchkes being sold, and, you know, there's a whole thing that goes with it, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it, unfortunately, those sort of things tend to marginalize the subject to a certain degree. So
absolutely. Actually, you know, I think there is something wrong with that. I think they should be banned from selling any of the alien paraphernalia at these things. It just really makes, you know, what happens is the media comes in there mm-hmm. and they focus on it. They'll focus exactly. on the guy with the tinfoil hat and exactly. Make mockery of the whole thing. And then, you know, the whole cause of the thing just goes down the drain. So, yeah, I really wish that wouldn't be allowed. You know, I mean, T-shirts, something like that, fine. But, you know, when they have those little plastic aliens and, you know, the things you put on your refrigerator and stuff like that, it mm-hmm. gets a little carried away.
It does. And that was what was great about Exeter is at Exeter, all of the town local businesses would, you know, have little alien things and would sell. But at the actual event itself, there was just the speakers, and there was a room where the speakers could sell their books. So, you know, there were still people outside with alien costumes, and, you know, there was events separate from the lectures. But that was one of the great things is, you know, they kept kind of the fun activities and the actual lectures. There was a little separation from that, so it wasn't like this, you know, big bombardment of, you know, alien toys. And so, you know, that was one of the things that I you know, think is good about the Exeter, you know, that they didn't allow outside vendors and, you know, they let the local town, you know, try and get some extra income from selling, you know, alien related things if they wanted to. So I thought that was kind of nice about Exeter Festival.
Now, do you know why that was canceled this year? Was it just not well attended last year?
No, actually, like I mentioned, there was, it's held at Historic Exeter Town Hall, and it was struck by lightning. And,
oh, that's where that happened. Oh,
yeah.
I see.
And initially uh-huh. they thought it was the repairs were going to be done in time to still do it, but then it wasn't, and they couldn't find a suitable venue. So from what I understand now, Dean, who is the creator and the organizer, he handed over the festival to the Exeter Kiwanis last January. So the Exeter Kiwanis are now at the helm. So I'm not really sure what's going on this year. I know they have announced that they're going to be doing one in 2014, but not much else has been announced other than that they plan on having one.
Very good. Well, Ryan, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and I like your balanced attitude. And, you know, I'm going to invite you back someday because I thought you did a nice job.
Oh, thank you so much, Martin. I thought you did a great job, too, and I really enjoyed this.
Very good. Well, that's it for the show today. If you missed any part of this show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can also check out our links to the stories and our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation on our forums. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Keith Rowland for producing Dark Matter Radio Network, John Tobin for joining us for the news, Andy Fleming for the astronomy look, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse, we have actually Suivak for the break music today. Peggy Shunning for managing the Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out live right here next week at the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't forget to jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.